to see Cruz at least gaining a little bit of momentum. I mean, that is at least a glimmer of hope, and, you know, because otherwise it's pretty disastrous. You know, as far as whose ability to do what when it's said and done, I mean, God knows that. I mean, God's in charge, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't, if we step back and said God's in charge, then he wouldn't have created the democracy he did and inspired the men to write the Constitution the way he did. You know, but he definitely, I'm confident that he had a hand in it, in establishing this republic to function in the way that it needs to function, and we need to be participants in it. Whatever level, yeah, you know. We need to be participants in it. You know, the whole electoral college thing is pretty suspect. You know, I can understand how it makes you feel pretty defeated. It seems to me like that is one of the things that was established. But my best understanding is that was something that was established when there was, you know, it was days away from the East Coast to the West Coast, and there was a whole different communication ability to do an election. But now the individual votes are able to be counted in an extremely rapid fashion. With near immediacy, it would seem like that would, it's overplayed its stay. I mean, I don't know. Is there another take on the Electoral College of why it's valid? You know?
Didn't the Founding Fathers establish the Electoral College for educated people to make the decisions instead of the voters?
Not instead of. It's a buffer.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it's a buffer so that, you know, if a Trump or worse or whatever, ends up winning the popular vote, there's an opportunity for people to say, well, hang on here, is this really what we want?
Mm-hmm.
And also it's a little like, if anything, it overrepresents rural areas. So there's a little bit more balance there between urban and rural.
That would seem like, except that, you know, when you take a predominantly urban-centered state, not necessarily not rural. I mean, California is a rural state, actually. But because of the megalopolises in California and the amount of electoral votes they have, how California votes dictates.
Right.
You know, how the left coast votes dictates, you know, basically in some ways, because they tend to throw all those into the pot rather than the rural vote in that state and getting a vote, you know, or getting a say.
But a state like Wyoming has bigger say in the electoral college than they would have.
Or Idaho, you know, except that Idaho's, it makes you, yeah.
Washington State, prime example, King County, Seattle, controls the whole state. You get, when I lived there, I voted for a Republican governor, and he won 37 of 38 counties, but he lost King, so.
You lose.
Won,
that's right.
That's
yeah.
Not right. That's yeah. The way it's set up, so.
I think that it is certainly something, you know, to me that we need to participate in. I'm at this point, it seems to me that our greatest value in is not necessarily in silently going and casting a vote in the secrecy of a booth, but in being vocal about what is right and wrong and what matters. You know, and being willing to speak in the community, being willing to talk, being willing to address. You know, it's amazing the pervading feeling that that's my vote and I have a right to it and I don't have to tell anybody and I'm not going to tell anybody, and how it's become, it's lost sight in many places of what you speak of around the table, you know, what you talk about in your home. And that's a tragedy. You know, the think of the overwhelming cultural mandate that you don't talk about religion and politics. I mean, what demonic oppression is that? You know, that you do not talk about religion and politics. I mean, if you can't talk about religion and politics, I would like to hear the great value you have of what to speak of. You know, doing it. It's changed. And you know, that they, I saw it change in our lifetime, young, tragically. And I'm not a, you know, those of you who know me could vouch for it. I'm not a chauvinist in any way, but the women's vote took on a very distinct flavor in politics. You know, any man that did not listen to the wisdom of his wife would be a fool. I'll make that very clear. But the vote was set up to be each household has a vote. And unfortunately, I mean, I watched it in my own home. And my dad was the head of our home. And my dad was a good man. My dad was a white man. But the cultural moray at that time was the wife can register in a different party and vote distinct from her husband because she has the right to do it. And it was almost because I have the right to do it, I'm going to exercise my right in opposition. And it was sad to me. And what that did, that killed the conversation at the dinner table. You know, because mom and dad aren't going to talk about politics now. Because mom, you know, I can vote the way I want and I don't even have to tell my husband, you know, because it's in the secrecy of my voting booth. And, you know, I don't know how many of you, I mean, my mom wasn't a rebellious woman. She was a submissive woman to my dad. And yet it was amazing to me growing up, I sensed rebellion in her voting. It was like the right of a woman to vote, so I can go vote the way I want to vote, and I don't, you know. And it was sad how then it just curbed being able to talk about politics if you do it. Not necessarily in our house, but it just curbed being able to talk about politics. You know, and at the time it wasn't even the great grand chasm that it is right now. I mean, at the time, Republicans and Democrats just had some distinctions in fiscal policy, basically. But at this point, I think there's a far greater divide than just fiscal policy. So we need to be participants in it. You know, we need to teach our children to be participants in it. You know, it isn't about our country is the most important thing, or it isn't about being Americans, but it is a position that God has put us in, and we're to be responsible with it, I think, in some ways no different than we are with our jobs, or other aspects of our life that God puts in our life. So, what's going to happen? I don't know. I don't see Rubio really having a way, you know, at this point. You know, I like Marco and what he stands for in a lot of ways. And can anybody explain to me why, hey, stranger, it's good to see you. Can anybody, and I'll quit after this, but can anybody explain to me why, what's so difficult to like about Ted Cruz? I mean, I like his policies.
Because he's not Donald Trump.
No, that has nothing to do with it. I disdain Donald Trump. But, I mean, what is it about him? I don't know what it is about him that finds difficult to like. I mean, when I hear him speak, I like him. When I hear his words, I like him. When I look at his record, I like him. When I look at what he's done, you know, to stand up for, you know, he took a pledge when he got elected to stand up against some things, and he did it to his demise. I mean, he got absolutely slammed and hated to the point where he's, you know, the GOP is hard against him right now doing it even because he took a stand. And, you know, he's definitely a constitutionalist. You know, I mean, the man memorized the Constitution, you know, doing it.
You don't like him or you're saying keep it
behind? No, I do like him. I don't know what it, but there's something that's not likable.
He's not like a public
I don't know what it is. There's something that doesn't seem likable. Is it his voice? Is it the fact that he's balding, or his pointy nose, or is it tone of his voice, or haircut? I don't know what it, I mean, I know it seems so petty and trivial. I'm trying to think of what is it about him that seems difficult for people to get behind. I mean, it's insane. What is it about? Because I found myself in some ways not being attracted to him. You know, and yet, well, I don't mean that in a bad way, you know, obviously, but I just wonder what it is that is found, because likability, I think, is a problem for him.
The liberals that I've talked to at Albertsons, they hate Cruz. They hate him because they think he's a, you know, because of his Christian
background. He's labeled right now as an extreme radical religious fanatic that's going to be. Yeah, it is. But I know, I stand for a man who has principles. I believe in a man who has principles. I'm attracted to a man who has principles. And there's just something about it that hasn't caught my affection.
Because he's not trying to Trump is so off the cuff, and Cruz talking seems very programming. And that measure, that unit of measuring and how he articulates his words makes me seem like it's almost like somebody who's gone on a stand at in court and pre-planned his answer. And so in that, it makes me question his
genuine.
Yeah. So, you know, that's been on the negative side of him. On a personal level, when we were in South Carolina, we set chairs. I talked to the lady who was there. We set chairs for his campaign, for his
caucus.
Yeah. And I was talking to her, and I asked her. She followed him from state to state. I asked her why, and she said she was Jewish. And she said because when there was a lack of support for Israel, and when he was just a governor, he was just starting out, I came to him and I talked to him, and he followed through with everything he said. He was going to follow through with. And she said that was 15 or 20 years ago. So in that, I have never seen him in anything that I had come and asked him about regarding that and the support of Israel. I have not seen him back away from. He was followed through with everything he said he was going to.
So it keeps his word.
So she said that his integrity was what?
Well, I think that's what his record shows. I think that's what his history shows. I don't think you can find it. Was he governor?
Or senator.
Yeah, okay. That's good. But I've seen that about him too. And to me, I don't think there's a more valuable, important attribute of a president than a man of integrity. You know? I'll take. Doesn't know on the topics, doesn't understand topics. Well, you're not going to know everything anyway, you know. You're going to get some bright advisors that come in if you're a man of integrity. You're not going to get yes men, but, you know, integrity, and it seems like he's been a person of integrity. That's what's difficult for me about the rehearsed answer thing. It seems that way. Is that what it is? It seems that it's rehearsed answer?
I think there's such a stand on not being a politician that almost all the public, everybody that's been up there has been attacking that. So when he comes across that way, and he comes across rehearsed, it makes him seem that way.
Hmm.
And so he puts him in his head. That's just my opinion.
Well, he's an attorney. He was successful when he argued cases before the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So being able to articulate a point clearly is, you know, is one of the things that he built his career on.
And trained in and
so
is good at.
Part of it is that he has a big intellect and doesn't make any attempt to hide it.
He won most of them.
It seems to me. And I think people might be a little turned off by that, but there's, you know, that there is a serious intellect there that comes out pretty regularly.
Huh.
He's just very well spoken because he knows what he thinks and he sticks with it. There was a video clip when he was in Iowa, him talking to a farmer who was very angry with him about the ethanol subsidies, because he's against all subsidies. But he really, it was, you know, he just didn't stumble. He he came to his point quickly and convinced the guy to not even do this mob thing, but he, you know, made friends with it anyway. And I just think it sort of, it could have been rehearsed, but it wasn't that one because he didn't know the question was coming. So he just knows what he thinks, so that's what comes out.
That would, what it seems to me, that he's just, he's, his mind's brilliant. And he's able to come back with an articulate answer, whatever's thrown at him, it seems like. And so it would seem rehearsed, although.
Do you think it's like a news reporter where they have that certain tone that they have when they're reporting the news? And then they don't, you know, they always talk about other things, they don't shut it off and the lawyer, and does he always comes in that tone?
I don't know. You know, I'm trying to figure it out, kind of, because, you know, I mean, when you compare the two, I mean, it's like there's no comparison. You know, I mean, they're like between Trump and a Cruz. I mean, they're like polar opposites almost. You know, they're both in some ways seen as the anti-establishment candidate, but they're just like polar opposite. I don't. You know, I think it's baffling to everyone, or to most sane people, I would assume anyway. It's baffling where we are right now, and how we're sitting as a country, you know. But. I mean, I think that's a pretty given. Yeah, I don't think there's any way out of that. You know, doing it.
But and that's part of it too, because
I'm not sure which one's more scary, honestly, myself, my own personal opinion.
But with the open election, there's a lot of Democrats voting Trump. So that's
to get him there.
Yeah, because they want that to be our candidate, because then they have a shot with Hillary.
Wow.
So that's what happened. Is well, there's no kind of crossover.
Is that what happened in South Carolina?
I don't know. It's
so messed up. Well, didn't Mary say her dad did that? He registers as a Democrat, but he registers as a Democrat so he can vote in their primary.
Right, is what he does to vote against. To make it worse for them. And then a lot of, well, there's a lot of open elections, so you can have a primary, you don't have to declare your party, you can vote for any of the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And not, it used to be that way here, and they changed it.
I think it should be one day, and I'll vote one day.
What do you think it is doesn't matter at the moment, so. Yeah, I don't, it's a pretty wild ride. We'll see what happens. There's a lot of very important courses of this country at stake, you know. And as most of you that know me know, I mean, the course to this country changing has little to do in some ways with who we, if, you know, somebody who gets elected right now isn't going to make the true effect. What's going to make the effect is men and women, being men and women of God and raising godly children up. And that's a generation away, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, that, so to me, the valuable thing, the important thing is to vote for candidates that are not anti-family, that are pro-life, pro-family and pro-life in their values. Because having that family pro-life, belief system, godly, biblical belief system, decay further is destructive in the family. You know, you look at, we were talking this weekend with a gal that, you know, looks at, should be free stuff and should be free college. I believe in free college and whatnot. But you look at our, welfare system, and our welfare system has degenerated the family in a huge way. In that the way it's structured and the way it's set up, if a man hangs around in a poverty community, the woman gets less benefits. And so, you know, it's just, she doesn't even want the man around because she's going to get less benefits. And so now you look at a degenerating culture, in the black community, now in the Hispanic community, less so in the Hispanic, but becoming in the Hispanic community where they, the dads are, you know, tell me I can be irresponsible and don't have to take responsibility, and most of us are pathetic men that will go do that. And go leave, and that's what's happened. And, you know, so I look for, you know, bigger government will not be pro-family, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I think, you know, government that is small and requires men to go be what men are supposed to be and be responsible with what they're supposed to be is pro-family in some ways doing it. But that, you know, I think that right now, you know, do I think that there's salvation in a cruise or in a whoever? No. But do I think it's important to not continue to degenerate so that we have the opportunity to raise up a generation? We should be part of that. We should be about that, because that's what's going to change. When you raise children who are raised, you know, the millennials, as far as I'm concerned, is an incredibly, and this is stereotyping, but is an incredibly narcissistic generation. Is an incredibly selfish, self-absorbed. It's about them. Don't necessarily believe in civic duty. Don't necessarily believe in putting others before themselves. Don't understand that. They were raised in homes where parenting was terrible often, and they didn't understand they weren't the center of the universe. They didn't understand that the world didn't revolve around them. And that's what it takes for this country to function correctly. You don't become an adult and all of a sudden learn that, you know, you're not the center of the universe and things are going to go well. Usually when you become an adult, when for the first time you're learning that it's not all about me, it usually doesn't go well. You know, usually by then you're divorced because your wife doesn't agree with you and this woman and your kids, and now you got a whole other generation is a mess. And so for us to participate in raising up a generation that believes it has responsibility to others before themselves, that you have a responsibility to regard others as more important than yourself. And, you know, most of all, obviously, that you serve a God who is higher than you. And there's an accountability there. So I think that voting for pro-family, pro-life values is very important. We have a bunch of Supreme Court justices, or maybe a couple of Supreme Court justices, obviously, is pretty tenuous right now. Sad that it's such a, you know, that we've got Supreme Court justices so divided. You know, where you've got, I mean, it shouldn't be that way. You know, I wish they were all people of the book, people of the word, and people of truth, but they're not. They're not. You know, there's 50, you know, we're sitting in this fragile balance of those who don't believe in this value system in the Supreme Court. And it doesn't take much of anything to tip that over and start turning this country pretty sideways pretty quickly. So, that's up for grabs, obviously. And so it's a pretty important time. And, you know, to me, again, the great value that we have is to be willing to learn what is right and stand for what is right and become against for what is right. And are we willing to do that, you know, as people? So here we are in 1 Samuel. How'd we get started so late, man? Were you not ready to start singing or what? So, excuse me, we had the sickness and the plague hit me about Monday or something. And what is the deal? Man, we've had a sick second half of winter around here. It's been an ugly deal.
And like, you started talking about it in the first half of winter.
Nobody's gotten sick the first half of winter. It was all good, man. And then, boom. Just a smackdown. It was ugly. Speaking of men of integrity, we're in 1 Samuel. Speaking of David. Let's pray. God, we need your wisdom to understand what it means to have a relationship with you. Everything would be sorted out if we understood that as a people. Sorted out individually and personally if we understood that as individuals. You are a holy God. You are a God of integrity. And being in a right relationship with you mandates and dictates that we are people that follow that. That we are like-minded with you in that. We cannot act like spoiled little brats and think that our relationship with you is good. It's not true. So God, please teach us. Teach us what it looks like. I ask you to bless our time together also. Bless, I mean, make joy, make happiness, make security, make intimacy. Bring conversation, God, as we spend some time together sharing meal. To me, that time together is more important than this even. We're functioning in the gifts you've called us to function in and being led by your Spirit in each other's lives. God, I ask that you would give us the privilege and honor of being led by your Spirit, being taught by your Spirit, having our hearts illuminated by the truth. Thank you, Jesus, for giving us the privilege and honor of that being our lives. Amen. It's a pretty, chapter 18 of 1 Samuel is a pretty important book to me. You know, I'm not a one-verser and put your life on it, but I think that there's value in having a, maybe a life verse. I think there's value in, I know in different times in my life, God has used a section of scripture or a verse to be a, write it on my forehead, you know, for a period of time to change me, and I think that's important and that's valuable. This verse, and some, it has, you know, I have written in my Bible, verse that brought me back to God, that God used, thank you, Lord, you know. This is when I was back, 1975, something like that, you know, and, I was farming up in Oregon, and out of high school, and spent a year out of high school making really good money building race car chassis and motors, and life seemed pretty good. But I was raised in the church and longed to have a right relationship with God, but was not willing to pretend and was not willing to live an impotent life in my relationship with God. You know, sin, I had no power over sin in my life. So my life was this vicious uphill, downhill cycle. You know, sin, repent, you know, kind of thing. And I didn't understand freedom. I didn't understand what being free from sin was. I thought, well, shoot, I might as well eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow I may die. God had a different plan, and began ordering my life in such a way that that I'd cry out to him. I ended up going farming up in Oregon for a summer initially. I had a good job and a good paying job, but things got pretty hot around the home front. And so he took me to Oregon to farm, and I spent a summer on a combine and tractor and windrower, and, you know, 12 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week. And you can teach a monkey how to combine, you know, and I was the monkey in the combine, driving along thinking about a little bit of anything and everything. I mean, we're combining grass seeds, so you're not even running it as a swather, you've already run the windrower and let it dry, so you've got a robot this wide, and you've got a 12-inch basket in front of you that you're picking it up by, so you can be pretty tired wandering along and driving, doing it. It was a good time to think. It was a great time to think, and I began to think about what mattered to me and what was valuable and where I really wanted to go and what I was doing, what my life was about, and realized that the most important thing to me was having a right relationship with God, and that's what I really wanted. Jane and I were, she was down in back home then still, and in both of us, God was working in both of our lives. Back then, she was a junior in high school, going into senior year in high school. It was that summer prior, and so I asked my parents to send me a Bible, and you know, that I think that came the next day or something. You know, I mean, they were like, you know, that was oh my gosh, you know, because they'd been praying fervently for me for years, and I got a Bible and began to read, and reading about David. And there's a verse here in 1 Samuel 18, verse 14, that says, "And David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him." And prospering, we need to be very, very careful to eliminate that from our cultural perception of prospering. We tend to tie prosperity so directly in our culture to monetary prosperity or material prosperity. The word doesn't mean material prosperity. The word means acting wisely. And it has nothing to do virtually with material prosperity. It has nothing to do with gaining monetarily or gaining materially. It means that you're acting wisely in your life because you're led by the Spirit of God. Now, let's be careful to, you know, there's a very bad universal in our culture, understanding that if you're struggling in life, that must mean you have sin in your life and God isn't part of your life. Well, that is not by any means true. Okay? You know, God seemed to make it, Jesus made it real clear, and God made it clear that in this life you're going to struggle. And if you're right with Him, you're going to struggle. You know, I can guarantee you in this life that the chasm is becoming greater. If you're going to stand for what is correct, as we were just speaking of politically, you're going to struggle. Okay? You're going to be opposed. You're going to be mocked. You're going to be ridiculed. You know, there's very, very little struggle that's more difficult than, I mean, financial struggle is tough. Most of us have probably been there and done that, and financial struggle can be really tough, no doubt. It can keep you awake at night and wake you up in the middle of the night. But rejection is a greater struggle, right? I mean, being rejected by people is even a greater struggle. And having people that we care about or we want to like us, not like us, or come against us, that's even a tougher one. And do not think that because, you know, we've the political correctness, that's one of the things that is, I think, attractive. I'm not sure what the phenomenon is, and I'm done with it for right now, hopefully, because it makes me crazy. But the political correctness that we have mandated in our culture is an amazing, amazingly tragic thing. And political correctness has to do with, I want to be liked by you. So I don't say things that offend you, or that bother you, or that come against you. And that's a terrible thing. You know, that's a, you know, it's permeated most of our culture, and I think it's one of the rebellions that's out there right now. That people are sick of political correctness. I mean, Donald Trump says things that we say, you would never say that in public. Nobody should ever say that in public. Nobody should ever, no politician particularly should ever say that in public. And there's a lot of things he says that no politician should ever say in public. You know, and that, I don't mean the swear words either, you know, just it's ridiculous. I mean, it's 12-year-old schoolyard bullying. It's just ridiculous on doing it. We should be far more mature than that doing it. But political correctness, he certainly isn't politically correct. And we've held that in such a high esteem. And the reason that we do is because we hold, you know, the praise of others as being such an extreme value. David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. When we read what happened, just prior to this, in a few verses, the most powerful man, the most important man in all of Israel had tried to kill him a couple of times. And was very angry at him and distrusted him and didn't like him. I mean, we think it's rough when the IRS is sending boys to knock on our door or make phone calls or something. This is the king who can do whatever he wants, who didn't like him and tried to kill him. So the concept that his life was just going so well, that would be a little bit of a misunderstanding. You know, prospering. You know, David was about to spend the next 10 years of his life hiding in caves and under rocks, playing the fool, having to pretend like a slobbering, mentally disabled person to escape death doing it. I mean, David was about to go 10 years of being chased around the desert with Saul trying to kill him relentlessly. You know, that's prospering? I mean, you know, I can guarantee you that wasn't fun. Especially out there. It's not like you're, you know, the desert over there. It's not that pretty of a place to hang out. You know, there's not that much to eat, and there's not very many trees to find shade in. And, I mean, it's a pretty gnarly place to be when you're running and trying to hide from somebody. Not water everywhere. I mean, they were thirsty. They were hungry. They were, you know, ugly, ugly times. And yet, David was prospering in his soul. And that's what matters. There is nobody in here that doesn't want to prosper in their soul. There's nobody in here who does not want all of us. You know, it's a pretty amazing thing. All of us in here believe in God on some level. And unfortunately, for most of us, for a great percentage of the time, that's relegated to when I need help. I need a decision. Things aren't going well. I'm in trouble. I need financial help. I need wisdom on a decision. I need whatever. When do most of us find ourselves on our knees? When do most of us find ourselves on our knees? When we're in trouble, right? When things aren't going well. And how is that view of God? You know, when you stand back and look at that, it's really important for us to understand the pretty base level. Now, don't misunderstand me. I absolutely believe that a right relationship with God is based on a recognition of our absolute need for necessity of dependency on Him. Okay? To the degree we realize our need for dependency on God, that'll be the degree of our right relationship with Him. We are utterly a right relationship with God, a right relationship as a created being under the authority of God, is in a position of absolute dependency on Him. Okay? That doesn't mean we don't stick food in our mouths and do all the other things that are necessary to do to get along the way. But the state of our soul is that my life is completely and utterly dependent on the mercy and grace and kindness and love of God. And that is something that we should all ultimately and absolutely strive for in our lives. The necessity, not self-reliance. It goes completely against our culture. Our culture is about self-reliance. Most of us understand our relationship with God looks like I walk through this life and I come to a point where I finally, God, I need you sometimes, so I add God to my life. And I continue walking in life, and when I need God, oh yeah, God, I need you here. Oh yeah, God, I need to add you to my life. And we continue to walk in life, and we continue to do our things in life, and we continue to go through life, oh God, I need you here, I need your help here, God. That would be a very wrong understanding of a right relationship with God. Okay? A right relationship with God would be very different, look very, very different than that. A right relationship with God would be that we live our life with an absolute understanding that without a right relationship with God, I am doomed. And eternally doomed. And forever doomed. And without hope. We should not want to take a step outside of, if we were cognizant of truth and reality. Someday we all will be. Someday all humankind will be. Someday all people will realize that either you understood the necessity of dependency on God, or you're eternally damned and wish you had. And you live in separation from him. Because we don't have a right relationship with God because we want to add him to our life. Because I want to add God to my life on whatever level, but we do not have a right relationship with him because we want to add him to our life. We have a right relationship with God because we acknowledge God as God. Okay? And acknowledging God as God will determine our lives, will influence every aspect of our life. We were listening to a sermon. We were listening to some sermon. Becky put a bunch of them on an iPod, and we listened to a boy named Matt Chandler, who's in a church that she might get involved in down there. It's a mega church, which is interesting. It was interesting. When we were flying from Dallas on the plane, the stewardess, I was actually reading my Bible. We were in the back of the plane, last seat in the plane. So, but I was reading my Bible, and the stewardess, I forget exactly the way that she, you know, did something about, are you a Christian? And she just continued to ask. She goes, are you a pastor? And I said, yes. And she goes, her first question was, what do you think about mega churches? You know? And I guess coming from Dallas, flying out of Dallas, she presumed that I must think that, you know. And I said, well, I think they might be teaching centers, but I don't think they have much to do with church. And they aren't churches, and they aren't a biblical church. You know, the giant, when you've got several thousand people that come to a meeting together on a Sunday, that has little to do with church. That has a lot to do with the teaching. It might be right, might be wrong. You know, might have tremendous value and eternal value for the kingdom, but the church needs to be much beyond that and a much more intimate level. Obviously, they're about breaking up into smaller groups and doing it. Nonetheless, the drawback of Matt Chandler Church, I think his teaching's good, yes. And we were listening to it because I think that he's a foundational teacher called by God in that community of believers. Now they've got a bunch of campuses, much like Seattle, like Mars Hill did. But anyway, we were listening to Matt, trying to hear his truth. And he spoke a lot of truth, I did it. But one of the things that he was speaking of, and I think is very critical for all of us, is, and you've heard me say it before in different ways, it was sweet to hear him distinguish it too, that there's a radical difference between knowing God and believing in God. And there, we would want to be very careful with that understanding, because I'm confident that the vast majority of those who call themselves Christians in this country know God, but do not believe in him. And knowing the interpretation of knowing is intellectual, giving intellectual assent to. Okay? You believe there's a God. You have correct, even theological understanding of the God of the Bible. But knowing something and being determined by it are two different things, right? You know, there's things in our life, all of us have things in our life that we know we should do. But knowing that we should do it, does that make us do it? No. If anybody in here says, oh yeah, anytime I know something's the right thing to do, I do it. No. You know you should be more healthy. You know you should not be addicted to this or that. You know you should not lose your temper to your children. You know you should read your Bible more. You know you should, right? But that doesn't necessarily determine what you do. Right? Knowing something and being determined by it are two different things. Believing is different. Believing is a state of your soul that determines what you do. Okay? And biblically, it's very important that we understand the difference. You know, I don't have to sit up here and speculate. When Donald Trump holds a vast majority in many states of the evangelical vote, we have a problem of what an evangelical is. Right? We have a big problem. You know, those who claim to be evangelicals will claim to know God. Those who claim to be evangelicals will claim to agree with the Bible. Those who claim to be evangelicals will claim to be Christians, I would assume. Right? I mean, I don't quite understand how you claim to be an evangelical and not claim to be a Christian. I assume the two would go pretty close together. And yet, they are voting for an incredibly godless, blasphemous man who has no integrity and is a liar and is untrustworthy. You know, a man who says he is a Christian, and yet a man who has done nothing in his life that would reflect anything but the opposite. Yeah, there you go. How does that work? How do you line that with he's a Christian, right? He's a Presbyterian, he's a Christian, yet he has not, do you guys hear that? That he has not asked for forgiveness because he has not done anything that requires forgiveness. You know? I would say that there could be very few more blasphemous statements. Right? When it comes, obviously the man does not know God, and yet he would claim to be a Christian. The thing that's so important here in looking at this is David just did a remarkable thing, right? David just fought Goliath. We read about that thing, right? We read about this in the distinction between David and virtually the rest of the men in Israel was knowing God or knowing about Yahweh and believing in God, right? David, the way that David acted was entirely different from the rest of the nation. So the rest of the nation, in response to Goliath, did what? They fled. They fled in fear. They fled in fear. Right? And yet they claimed to what? They claimed that they were the army of the true and living God. They claimed that they were soldiers under the army of Yahweh. Right? They claimed that God was there, that God went before him, that God would defend them, that God would protect them. But they didn't really believe that. That's not what determined their life. Was it determined David's life? Look at David's response. I mean, what a day. I think about this day sometimes. David got up really early and hiked, I don't know how many miles, to got up early enough with bread and grain and cheese, and went to the battle lines. But it was, I can't quite figure it out, but somewhere between 10 and 20 miles. He got up before breakfast, okay? And he showed up there first thing in the morning when they were all coming out to go draw up in battle array, okay? They were all coming out to line up on both sides of this valley. It's kind of sweet. I have a picture of it because I've actually seen contemporary pictures of it. Looking, and it doesn't look a lot different. Both hills are pretty bare still, and there's farm ground in between in the middle, on it. But they drew up on both sides, and they both stand up there, and, they came out cheering and yelling and screaming, yeah, we're in it, after 40 days of this, twice a day, and running in fear. David came up there and saw them coming and ran out to the front, dropped his baggage with the baggage keeper, ran out to the front line and said, okay, what's happening here? And Goliath came up and just said, you guys are the followers of Yahweh. You guys are the followers of your gods, but come on out here. If you are, come on out here. I mean, this is, and David's going, did you hear what he said? You hear what he said about our dad? Did you hear what he said about our dad? Wait, yeah, shut up, kid. Of course we heard, I mean, his brothers, right? His brother said, get out of here, you stinking punk. You're making fun of me. What you're saying is I'm scared. Well, I am scared, but get out of here. Don't point it out to me. He's going, what are you scared for? They're mocking our God. God is not to be mocked. God is not okay with being mocked. I mean, David staked his life on it. Look at the transformation from running there to see his brothers, to bring news of his brothers back to the father, to, okay, and the thing that we need to always keep in mind when we look at David is, when Samuel anointed him a few chapters ago, he anointed him with oil in front of his brothers, right? It said the Spirit of God came mightily upon him from that day forward. Let me just say, there is nothing we should long for more in our life than the Spirit of God to come mightily upon us. I mean, that's another one of those, I know and I believe things. All of us in here have heard that when you're born again, when you're saved, the Spirit of God comes and lives in you. I would encourage us, myself included, that we all take that far too lightly. Do we really believe that? Do we really believe that we can have the Spirit of God living in us? Living in us! In the fullness of the deity. Not just I'll give you a little pixie dust of me, you know? No. The fullness of the deity living in us. David manifested being led by the Spirit of God, being anointed when he was anointed. He was led by the Spirit of God. And David's life reflected that. Decisions that he made reflected that. David's actions reflected that. His attitudes reflected that. Everything was reflective of the fact that he was led by the Spirit of God. David was prospering in all his ways. David was acting wisely because the Lord was with him. I want us to understand something. And I guess this is the challenge that I want to leave us with today. What does it mean because the Lord is with us? What does that mean? It means because we have a cross on? You know? Does it mean because I gave intellectual assent to say, Jesus, come into my life and be my Savior? Does it mean that I've spent time pursuing Him for a percentage of my life, you know, in doing that? What does it mean the Lord is with us? I'm sorry for not being able to be more charismatic in teaching, but people, there is nothing more important. And that statement could be said about you. That the Lord is with you. I mean, there is nothing more important. If God is for us, who can be against us? That was David's, definitely his stance. I mean, look at what it produced in David. In verse 45 of chapter 17, I'll just read it for you. Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the army of Israel, whom you have taunted." Excuse me. This day, I mean, this is a day, man. He got up early this day, okay? And the Spirit of God has fired him up. This is the same day. This day, the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And that all the assembly, all the people here, both sides of this valley, will know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. Then it happened, when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly towards the battle line to meet this Philistine. That was a man possessed. Oh, yeah, it was, by the way. A man possessed by the Spirit of God. A man who was controlled and led by the Spirit of God. I mean, this day really kind of... He didn't get up in the morning thinking this was going to happen. Okay? It's not like he'd been... I mean, if any of us had this kind of battle, I mean, all of us have had something athletic or something that we're going to do in our life that we've all kind of looked forward to and prepared. The big game or the big this or the big that, right? What? Opening day, yeah, you know, that we're preparing for, we're getting ready for, all these for. It seems to me like he'd spent no time. There's nothing to give us any indication. He did not go there intending to kill Goliath. He went there intending to see his brother. But he acted wisely because he was led by the Spirit of God, because he was submissive to the Spirit of God. If David had not... How do I say this in a way that, because I think this is a really, really important thing. God is not just in our lives for when we need Him. Okay? Most of us live that way. Most of us, when we need something, when we're in trouble, when we don't really know, when we don't have answers, is when we go, God, help me. Right? It's when we cry out and say, God, help me. if David had lived his life that way, would this day have happened? This day would not have happened. Because all of us in that time, if that's the way we live our lives, and to the degree we do, and to the degree all of us do, myself included on some level, I'm grateful for these last 5 or 6 years, 7 years that have been some of the toughest financially ever in my life. It's made me spend a lot of time on my knees. Should I spend that much time on my knees no matter what? I should. But I might not have. Okay? So I'm grateful for it. I'm grateful for my recognition of my necessity of dependency that God has made in the forefront of my mind in doing it. But if to the degree we all live our lives that way, but when we cry out to God for something in need of help, you know, I need a decision, I need to know it, how strong is our faith in that? How strong is our trust in that when we try to add him to my life right now? And God, I really want to be submissive to you, and you know, maybe I'll make you some promises about reading my Bible or being devout or, you know, going to church, or I'm going to start tithing or whatever it might be that we make deals with God about. If you will do this, then I will do that. But how strong is our faith when we do that? We're going, God, did you hear me? Are you listening? Are you there? Are you going to answer? Are you not going to answer? You know, is that how David was living his life? I think it's pretty apparent that is not, you know, it says the Lord is with him. This is a walk that David walked in pretty continuously, pretty consistently. He had no doubt, he didn't have to stop and go, hey, you guys, give me a minute here. I got to think about this. I mean, this guy is pretty tough, and God, you're pretty tough, but are you, you know, what do you think, God? Can we take him, you know? I mean, there was no thought in his mind when you read this. He's focused, he was aware, he was led by the Spirit of God. There was no second guess, there was no second thinking about this. The Lord was with him because David lived his life in submission to the Lord. David lived his life walking with God. Good times, bad times. That's what it means the Lord was with him. The Lord isn't just there in our lives to come in and fill in emergencies or in case to do the things we can't quite handle ourselves. All of us have this propensity to just live our lives out until we kind of stumble or need some extra help or extra money or extra advice or extra wisdom. No. That's not the way David lived his life. That's what it means that the Lord was with him. The Lord walked with David. David was led by the Spirit of God. If we wait till we're in trouble, if we wait till we really need him, we're just beginning to become aware of the realities of life. We are not walking with God. God is God, no matter what our circumstances look like, no matter how we acknowledge him, no matter how things are going, God is God. Are we determined by that? Are we determined by the fact that my life is about worshiping the true and living God? Period. Good times, bad times, sideways times, all times. That's what determines my life, is that God is God, and my purpose in life is to honor him and to worship him and to walk with him. Is that what determines us, or we just do that when we need some extra on the side, need some a benefit of God? Because if so, David would not have had the courage, would not have had the compulsion, would not have had the drive, would not have had the absolute knowing that God, you've mocked God, and God, he was, it doesn't say that the Spirit of God said, go, and I'll use you. But I guarantee he knew that, right? David was not saying, well, let's see if I can do it. David was not hesitant, right? He was not going, whatever. He walked with God. He was led by God. There's a sweet, sweet relationship here. Jonathan understood that. In chapter 18, verse 1, it says, now it came about when he had finished, after he killed Goliath, he cut his head off. It was a good picture for me, like I told you two weeks ago when we were talking about this. I was looking up David and Goliath, and just kind of the history of the story and how it's evolved to this little kid Sunday school story, and you know, there was a bunch of illustrations in the old days when they could get away with it more. And there was one where, you know, David is holding up, carrying Goliath's head, you know, and because he cut it off, and he carried it all the way to Jerusalem. And then he went to Gilbo, it seemed like, or Gilbeth, where Saul seemed to have his headquarters, which was a ways north of there even. But how big was a 9.5-foot guy's head? You know? I don't know. Big. I mean, I have this illustration in my mind of, because I saw this picture back when they could do it. I mean, there's guts hanging out and blood hanging out in this picture. You know, doing it. I mean, it was just this. And he's carrying his head, and he has to hold it about this high so it's not dragging, you know, by the hair doing it on it. God said he carried his head, so we should get that picture in our head, okay? This isn't David being extreme. God said it. He cut his head off, and he carried it to Jerusalem. And then he carried it back in front of Saul. It says right before that, they carried it in verse 57 of the chapter prior. So when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. He carried the Philistine's head, and now understand something. Saul and Jonathan were the two toughest guys in Israel. The Bible talks about that earlier. It talks about, I mean, Saul was a brave guy. He came from a lineage of brave guys. He was a big guy, and he wasn't just a big teddy bear. He was a fighter. He came from a lineage of fighters. He came from a tribe of fighters that were known for being valiant warriors on doing that. They were tough fighters, and he fought. He led battles. He was the head above everyone else as far as size-wise. He's a big guy, and they were fighters. And Jonathan, we read about him a few weeks ago too, right? I mean, this guy was the real deal. I mean, here's a guy when you've got, you know, thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of opponents standing on the other side, and there's 600 of you total with wooden sticks and pitchforks, you know, like kids' toys, because they couldn't have any. And he's the only one, he and his dad are the only one with swords even. And he said, all right, see his armor bearer and crossed over and challenged them all. Jonathan was led by the Spirit of God too, I'm confident. Right? That's why it's very angering me. You know, I'm not sure all of you. Most of you who have been around Christianity have heard this story of David and Jonathan used by the homosexual community to condone homosexuality. And there's few things that make me madder. Okay? It was tentative to speak of it, but I think it needs to be addressed because in our culture it's huge. Right? You know, how many of you have heard that? You know, that it's David and Jonathan are the validation of homosexuality. There could be nothing further from the truth. You know, when I thought about it, I thought, I would like to see David and Jonathan standing here right now and see you say that. You know? Because I guarantee it wouldn't go well. There was absolutely, absolutely nothing immoral, sexual, certainly not homosexual about their relationship. Okay? This is a relationship that we as men should long for. And it has nothing to do with immorality and sin. David shows up, he spoke to Saul, he spoke to them, you know, told them the story of what had happened, and it says, now it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul, chapter 18, verse 1, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. It means bound together with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. Let me just say, man, that is a relationship that few of us will ever know much about in this life, but we should all long for. That's a wondrous thing. That is a wondrous thing. They were bound together, knit in their souls. And I mean, this was a big deal. Jonathan is the king's son. Jonathan is the heir to the king. Jonathan is, you know, he's like second in command, you could say. I mean, he's the real deal. He's the king's son. He's the heir to the throne. And it came about when they'd finished speaking that his soul was knit to David. But you think about that. Jonathan had done something much like this not very long before that, right? When he crossed over that valley and challenged the Philistine. He understood it. But when Goliath came up, he was with his dad going, oh man, I don't know about this one. I don't know how this one's going to go. And when he saw David led by the Spirit of God, they were bound together. I'm confident that this had to do with they were both men that were led by the Spirit of God. They were both men that understood submission to authority. They were both men. What did Jonathan say when he crossed over and fought the Philistines prior to this? He said, let's see what the Lord, was it about him being a tough guy, or was it, let's see if the Lord will deliver. The Lord doesn't deliver by spear or by sword. Let's see, God wants to deliver. He was led by the Spirit of God to go over there and fight, and it routed the Philistines and gave them the freedom to be able to go on as a nation. I mean, it was a huge, huge victory led by the Spirit of God, acting wisely, prospering in all his ways. Jonathan was prospering in his ways, acting wisely, because the Lord was with him. Okay? And when he saw another brother who was led by the Spirit of God, who was selfless, David didn't consider, man, I could die here. There's nothing in it that shows anything about fear or self-reflection even in David when he fought Goliath. His eyes were on Jesus. His eyes were on his warrior God that was going to deliver him. His eyes were not on himself or his own abilities. That's why his life looked like it looked. And Saul took him that day. It did not let him return to his father's house. I'm confident that David understood this was going to happen. That's why he was concerned about his father. Remember, he kept asking the people around him, what's going to be done for the father of the family of those who goes and fights this guy? Because I want my dad taken care of. Because when God uses me to go destroy this guy, to go trash this guy, I'm not going to get to go back to herding sheep anymore. Okay? I think David understood that. And that's what happened. It says that he didn't let him go to his father's house anymore. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. This was a kingly robe. This is a robe that identified Jonathan as the son of the king. Okay? This was, I don't know exactly the royal colors, the royal, you know, embellishings on it, but this was the real deal. And he gave that to David. That's huge. One of the things that we talked about as men last Thursday, and I would just ask you to continue to, you know, I think that it is a very, very important theme for the next, whatever, extended period of time with us as men, is what does respect mean? What does respect look like? I think that is imperative. And one of the aspects of respect, one of the things that I see in David is a man who understood respect. A man who understood submission to authority. I believe that's why he walked with God, because the Lord was with him. He understood submission to authority, not only to his God, but by the environment and the situations that God allowed him to be in. He trusted his God to determine his life. You know, it says back in the chapter prior, when he was confronting Saul initially after he saw Goliath, and he said, I'll go fight him. And how does he address Saul? He says, your servant was tending his father's sheep. In verse 36 of the previous chapter, it says, your servant has killed both. He put himself in the position to Saul as servant. He'd been anointed king. He knew that, didn't he? He'd already been anointed king. So he knew that he was anointed king. And yet he still positioned himself with respect. Jonathan acted with great respect towards David in this case, okay? I think that we need to, what does respect mean? It means a willing to submit to. Okay? What does that look like in our relationship with each other? How are we to treat? You women need to be with us in this, because this is a journey I think we're going to go down. I think it's something very lost in our culture. And it's not outward pretend titles, you know. This town, something that disgusts me about this town is very title-oriented, right? I mean, oh, this is so-and-so. I remember when I was president of the gun club for several years, and we got invited because there was a lot of very, very wealthy people that came and shot. And I taught shooting, and I was president of the gun club. So because I had a title, I got invited to all the parties, you know. These garden parties, you know, very wealthy people. Yeah. And they introduced me always. They wouldn't just say, this is David. They'd say, he's the president of the gun club. He's a shooting instructor. He's our shooting instructor. He's got a title. You know? As soon as I didn't have that title, I didn't get invited anymore to the gun club. You know, doing it. I mean, it didn't make me feel, oh, yes, I got a title. This town's very, very much about titles. Wealthy people are very much about that. They're very much about dropping names, you know, I know so-and-so, or this about titles and giving titles. That's a false sense of respect, okay? It's not what I'm talking about. Respect in this thing is as Jonathan did, surrendering my will to your. It is tied intimately with love, okay? It is tied intimately with the biblical understanding of love. God says that we are to love God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, and with all our strength, and we are to love our neighbor as ourselves. I would contend that you could substitute respect in there, and partially, not fully, because the word love in the Bible goes even further. But respect is an integral part of both those, in relationship to God and to others. Okay? Women, I want you to understand this, because you're commanded to respect your husband. You might not like that, but it's truth, okay? Not very many of you in here. Now, there's a couple of things there. Number one, if a man, I'm of the opinion that if a man is not respectable and does not act respectable, you're causing your wife to sin. It's very difficult. She's charged to love you. That's a commandment she has from God to love. I mean, to respect her husband. The Bible doesn't command her directly to say, the prominent isn't love your husband. It's respect your husband. As men, we're commanded to love our wives, and that doesn't mean like them a lot. It has nothing to do with that. It means surrendering and submitting regarding them as more important than themselves. The example we have is Jesus Christ laying his life down for the church. Dying for her. Dying to yourself. Regarding them as more important than yourself. Okay? That's what we're called to do. I am convinced that we are also charged as men to respect our wives. That's hard to do sometimes. I know you girls say, oh, what do you mean? Well, it just is, okay? Say, just like the Bible says we're commanded not to become embittered towards our wives. There's a reason God said that, okay? Because sometimes you would encourage that. Bad behavior in men, okay? I know you don't think you do, but we would not think we are act disrespectful either, but we do. We act disrespectful. We are commanded to understand, I think, and we are called to understand what respect is. So I think it's very important, and I would challenge you wives to participate in this with your husbands, because I think it is a very important journey we're going to go down in the next to understand what respect is. This isn't about giving formal invites. Oh, hi, Brother Levi. It's so good to see you here. I respect you, you know. This is not about some false sense of we're going to act respectful to each other, okay? But what does it mean? What does it mean? And is it mandated by how I treat you? Is that dictated by how you are and how you act? Or is it something I'm called to do regardless of how you act and who you are? The same way our wives are commanded to respect their husbands. I'm doing that. I think that it is a very important thing. And respect has nothing to do with giving address or giving title to or some formality that we participate in. You know? Let me just say this. It has nothing to do with political correctness. Okay? That is how it's interpreted. Most churches are very politically correct. We come in and act with respect towards each other, right? Which would mean, well, we come in and, yes, brother so-and-so, my walk with God is great, you know, doing it. Oh, your walk with God is great, you know, doing it. We come in and we have these formal address and we tell each other, try to present what a picture we have of our lives so we'll get the respect and people will envy us. And Facebook. Facebook is a great, great, we present what we want people, how we want people to respond. Okay? Not all Facebook. I am generalizing and stereotyping, but a vast majority of it, and a very dangerous part of Facebook is, you know, I think I shared it last week, you know, one of the most amazing things to me in watching this, that party where we gave snowmobile rides and four-wheel rides to this platinum party out at Tony's last Sunday night. Oh, I guess you wouldn't have, because that was last Sunday night, right? So, but what was amazing to me about this, here's 300 extremely wealthy people, okay, that we were giving snowmobile rides and, you know, they're doing all kinds of activities. And it blew me away, because I would contend, I don't know how you observed it, Levi, but the most important thing to them was really not participating in this activity, because to them a snowmobile ride was like, you know, going to Mount Everest or something. This was a very out of their box. You know, none of them had ever been in the wilds before. You know, but they cared more about taking selfies and pictures than they cared about the experience. That was the most important side to them, was getting a picture taken, having somebody take a picture of it. Why? Because it mattered to them. It wasn't about actually participating in the moment and what was happening and what was going on. It was about what will this produce in my response from other people? What will this picture of me on the snowmobile, this picture of me in this, we had this really cool turbo razor that had tracks on it that we had to make sure was broken in well. And so we gave them rides in that for the night too. And it was pretty Western. It had red lights all the way around it. It was kind of other nationality, I would say. You know, wouldn't necessarily be my style anyway to put lights in your wheel wells and all around the bottom of it. But what was so cool is when you stood on this thing out in the snow, the snow would fly everywhere on it, and it would be red, you know? So it looked like there was red snow flying everywhere. Things go. It was cool, you know, doing it. So it was cool. But the only thing they really cared about, more than anything, it wasn't being in the moment and being in the presence and doing what they're doing. They cared about the response they were going to get from people because of the pictures they posted of themselves. I mean, it is what has created the whole GoPro phenomena, you know? It isn't that we get to see such cool things, it's just we get to post stuff on our Facebook page that causes other people to envy and look at us and go, I wish I was there. God, look at them, they're so cool. Look at them, they get to do cool stuff. You know, I wish I was cool. And if somebody else says, I wish I was you, then that must mean I'm somebody special, right? If somebody else wants to be me, that must mean I'm special, right? And so it's this form of affirmation we get, not because we participated, not this gratification and satisfaction and joy or happiness we get from being in the moment and just experiencing what is going on. It's about, no, I got to get selfie. I got to get pictures here so we can post it. Because the affirmation that matters is how people are going to respond on my Facebook page. Or wherever place they post it these days. I don't know where they post it. Wherever they're doing it. And that is such, so much of who we are. Is that respect? Is that reality? Or is that being willing to participate in something completely other than? I mean, respect is something that is very much in the moment, in the present, from the depths of your soul, in the way you respond to someone. Okay? It isn't about formal greeting. It isn't about calling somebody sir. It isn't about calling somebody by a title. It is about posturing from the depths of your soul. It's about how Jonathan responded to David here. And Jonathan recognized in his life that David was prospering in all his ways, that David was acting wisely. We need to be, there should be very few goals or desires or journeys we want to go down or things that drive us than to have that be said of us. that Richard, that Levi, that whoever, that Eric, that Mallory, that whoever was prospering, was acting wisely in all her ways because the Lord was with her. And let me just say this. That will be apparent and should be apparent. We need to be very careful to have the world's eyes and say, well, financially, well, monetarily, but are you making wise decisions about life? With your children? With your spouse? With your friends? With the people you meet on the street? Are you stumbling and bumbling through life, acting in your flesh, being led by the flesh, and crying out to God when you really need some help? Are you regarded as someone who it's obvious the Lord is with them and leading their life? Because our life should be apparent. I mean, it's a pretty insane postulate. We would say, I hope all of us believe, that if you were possessed, completely possessed by a demonic spirit, that would be pretty obvious, right? Well, now we're talking about being possessed by the Spirit of God, the true and living God. And yet, it's not obvious? That should be obvious. It should be obvious that the Lord is with us, that our lives are guided and determined by walking with the Lord. Jonathan was attracted to that. Jonathan was attracted to that in a profound way. That relationship, that intimate relationship that he had, there's few things in life that are more to be cherished in this world than that level of relationship. Some of us will get to have with our wives, some of us won't. You know, that we should be bound intimately together in our souls, in the depths of our souls. But we should long for that intimacy. But I believe that the baseline of that, the important side of that, what it makes it so difficult. I don't think that we treat with respect. We don't treat God with respect. Why don't I treat God with respect? Because I regard myself as more important than Him. So I don't treat God with respect when I don't. Because I regard myself as higher than Him. I regard myself as a more valid authority at the moment than Him. The opposite of respect. And it's the same thing with each other. Why don't we respect each other? Because I regard me of greater value than you. My life of greater value than you. I don't think that we can understand what God means about love unless we understand what God means about respect. The respect is a true, not a fake, but true from the depths of your soul regarding someone. And I will respect you as a creature of God, as a son and daughter that God has created that longs to have a relationship with you, and that He longs to have a relationship with, and that gives you greater value and greater worth than anything. And I will respect that, and I will treat you with respect accordingly. That's not kissing butt. That's not blowing smoke. That's not all the other pathetic ways that we pretend to do that. That is a state of your soul. Jonathan was already selfless. Jonathan regarded God as a high authority in his life. As the high authority in his life. It was easy for him when he saw a man led by the Spirit of God, consumed by the Spirit of God, to submit to Him in respect. And act that out. So, I would challenge all of you. I challenge you wives. I would challenge you husbands because I think that it is very important. I challenge you single people, you know, to go after what does it mean to respect from the depths of your soul. Because God has called us to do that and act in that way. And I also challenge you to look at that verse in David, substitute your name, put your name in. It just happens to be mine. It was pretty fitting, but not that I'm like David, but it was pretty fitting. He is my hero. Okay? He is my hero. Substitute your own name in there. Okay? And Casey was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. And that's what you want your life to look like. What does it mean? He was acting wisely in all his ways because the Lord was with him, walking by him, side by side, daily. Let's pray. God, that is comprised by a lifestyle that, in our hearts, that you say is mandated in our response to you of honoring you, our Father who is in heaven, how holy, how far above others is your name. That we live in respect and awe and reverence of you. And that we live in submission and that your kingdom would come, that your will would be done on earth as it is in heaven. Not God, be here to propagate my will and my heart and my desires and what I want. But that your will would be done on earth like it is in heaven. And that is with absolute submission and surrender to your authority. So God, I ask that you would cause us to challenge ourselves with what do we know in our heads and what do we believe in our hearts? What is it that, about you that truly determines us, and what is it that we're content to just have correct intellectual understanding of? Because correct intellectual understanding of is not, that's the demons. The demons know you and shudder in fear. That's probably a step above most of us. Our view of you isn't even such that it causes to shudder in fear. Let's less submit to you. It causes to question that, God, that the things that we say with our mouth, that they don't parallel our lives, to be shocked and to be troubled and to be burdened by that and to be willing to change that. God, thank you for the privilege and honor of being able to turn our eyes upon Jesus and look full in his wonderful face, so that the things of this earth, so that the giants, so the Philistines will look strangely dim in the light of your glory and grace. Goliath didn't look big compared to you, because that's whose David's eyes were on. God, please protect and bless this time. Cause us to act and live and respond and respect in a way that would honor you. Amen.